Heavenly Father, we do just pray for John this morning as he speaks to us from this very ancient story. We're conscious that you've given us your word, and we just pray for our edification and application today. It seems like such an ancient and bizarre story in some ways, and yet it's in your word, Lord, and it's good that we study it and look at it. So we just pray that you give John special wisdom and insight as he opens this up to us and as we seek to learn what we can from it. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you and good morning, everybody. I've enjoyed during the past few weeks just seeing how God can use ordinary people to do extraordinary things. And this morning we've got quite a colourful character, as Jonathan mentioned. I think it's perhaps a good job the children have left us before we look in depth at this story. I mentioned a couple of months ago that I felt a tinge of sadness when I heard that the boxer Muhammad Ali had died. I think there's a picture of the great boxer, if Laura can pop that up there. He was an endearing character and a highly charismatic entertainer. His mother once said of him, when Cassius was a boy, he talked and he talked and he talked, and when he couldn't think of anything else to say, he talked some more. He had a real gift of the gab, Muhammad Ali. But what I was interested in was some of the tributes that were coming in the radio and on the TV. There was a retired headmaster from Brixton, South London, telephoned in, and he recalled a time in 1974 when Ali had visited his school. He described it as absolutely inspirational for the pupils there. And he said, particularly as it came at a time of heightened racial tension in that community. Then Michael Parkinson, the interviewer, he spoke about three times that he'd interviewed Ali during the 1970s and early 1980s. And he said it was really sad to see this irrepressible entertainer robbed of his former vitality by illness and perhaps one fight too many. Parkinson actually had some quite harsh words to say about the boxing community, what they'd allowed to happen to this man. But the tribute that stuck with me most was a close friend of Ali's who travelled with him throughout the decades from when he was a young man. And he recalled a time, I think it was in 1974, when they were all in Zaire. It was going to be a very, very famous boxing match, which had been dubbed by the world's press as the Rumble in the Jungle. And George Foreman and Ali were going to meet in this multi-million dollar encounter. Ali had taken his entourage. And this great friend of Ali's said he also took his mistress for about 6 weeks before the fight took place. And all was going seemingly well till Ali's wife in the States heard about this. And she jumped on the first plane out there, and you can imagine he then had the fight of his life, and I think wife number two fairly quickly became wife number three. And this good friend of Ali's was saying that although Ali was undoubtedly the greatest boxer of his generation in a heavyweight sense, he did have a weakness, and the weakness was the relationships he engaged in, which would ultimately bring much pain to those around him. Now, we've heard a little bit about Samson already. He had God-given supernatural strength. Yet we've already sort of touched on one or two of the relationships that he engaged in, which would ultimately bring about his downfall. However, there is some good news, that God was still at work in this flawed character throughout his lifetime. It was difficult, actually, when I was trying to prepare for this talk, to separate the fact from the fiction. There are a couple of pictures, a bit like Jonathan put up. There was one of the 1949 movie, I don't know if Laura can pop it up there, where Samson and Delilah. That's the sort of thing that came to mind when somebody mentioned Samson's name. The other thing I sort of was thinking about in my mind, I heard Tom Jones ringing out, why, Delilah? Now, none of this was particularly helpful to the preparation for this talk. I don't know if you've heard, but there are remarkable similarities between the Roman god Hercules and the Greek god Heracle, Greek mythological character actually, Heracle, to Samson, even to the point that they fought with a lion. One of them married a beautiful woman with a name sounding like Delilah. And remarkable similarities there. Now, I wasn't alone in having this sort of tension in my mind, trying to separate fact from fiction. The Jewish Talmud, they'd become very concerned that this whole story was being reduced to myth, and they decided to do their own research. Now, the Jews are very good at researching genealogy, And they had actually traced back, and they would say that Samson's mother was Hezalelpuni, who is mentioned in the book of Chronicles. Now, we don't know if this is true because we don't even see his mother's name mentioned here. As recently as 2012, the University of Tel Aviv discovered a small coin in an archaeological site dating back about 3,100 years. And this coin depicted a man fighting a lion. And again, it isn't conclusive proof that Samson lived, but it does point to the fact that the people were talking about such a character exactly at that period. Now, I just want this morning to start briefly at the beginning of Samson's life and then to focus at the end. Because a little like Ali, it's often at the end of one's life that you're able to review it with a degree of objectivity. And it's perhaps worth bearing in mind that this extensive four chapters, which actually is quite small, over a few pages, covers a period of 40 years. So whereas these events seem to be happening thick and fast, there was quite long gaps between them all. I have a map there, and on the map you can actually see a little bit of the region where he was born. He was born in Zorah, which was actually in Israel, and that was right next to the Gaza Strip, where the Philistines occupied. And the Philistines actually had control over the Israelites because they had wandered off on their own way again, and the Philistines actually had control over the whole of Judah, and they oppressed them, if you like, at that time. We read how his parents were childless, and yet they had a visitation from an angel that they were going to give birth to this very, very special person. It's amazing how sometimes God visits people in their real pain. And the one thing that I think perhaps would be good, if you could remember one thing only from this talk this morning, is the angel's words at the beginning there. And they told Samson's parents that he would begin the deliverance of Israel from the hand of the Philistines. He would begin the deliverance of Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Now, the Hebrew word for judge, we've been looking at judges, when translated, actually means deliverer. And I think it's far more palatable, isn't it, to be labelled a deliverer than a judge. And Samson was going to be a deliverer of his people. Quite hard to see that reading some of this passage, but he was going to be a deliverer. This was God's purpose towards him. I did sort of mentally note that there were similarities, weren't there, between the birth of Samuel and the birth of Samson. Again, that visitation, if you remember Hannah, and the difficulty that they have at their time. Samson's parents were told to take out a Nazarite vow on behalf of their new son. And this Nazarite vow, you can read more about it in Numbers chapter 6. But in a nutshell, they were to touch no alcohol, not to touch a dead body, nor were they supposed to cut their hair as long as they lived. Now Samson, he came from the Danites, the tribe of the Danites, and they were, in a sense, homeless at that time. They wandered in their inherited territory. They were under the occupation of the Philistines. They were being suppressed in the Gaza Strip. It's kind of got a contemporary ring to it, hasn't it? That whole region, which is still under sort of controversial rule, was at that particular time. Now, I think that probably young Samson, from a young age, he would have heard some quite strong stories about these people, the Philistines, and what they did to his people. And it's every likelihood, to use a contemporary word, that he may have become radicalized at a young age. And that might just explain some of his extreme anger later on in his life. The first thing we read about him as a boy was in that verse that Ruth read in chapter 13, verse 24. And it said, "The Lord blessed him, and the spirit of the Lord began to stir in the boy Samson." Quite amazing, isn't it, how God works in young people. My first chat with Simon, our new minister here, was before he joined us. And he was just saying how it was as a teenager, as a boy, he first was influenced in his Christian walk. It was through an influential leader then. And it's incredible how God can sometimes use our past circumstances, use our upbringing. It might be something as simple as the kind of peer group we meet with, how we can use that later on just for his benefit and his glory. The Philistines, historians don't know terribly much about them. They were relatively sophisticated people. They were stable politically. We do know that they worshipped idols. They worshipped Dagon, who we read about there, who was often seen as the god of sea or agriculture, sometimes depicted as half man, half fish, like that. They were very licentious. They knew how to have a good time. And it's possible, I think, that as Samson looked at these neighbours of his, that as a young boy under all of the restrictions of the Jewish law, he might have envied them just a touch. He might have thought perhaps the grass is greener on the other side. I don't know. This is all speculation. But the first major event we read about was his marriage. Now, this was an unusual choice, to say the least. Samson travelled about 30 miles deep into Philistine territory to Timnah, where he met the woman that he wanted to marry. Now, it's ironic, isn't it, that the man who was there to deliver his people from idol worship travelled in amongst idol worshippers to find a wife. I don't quite know why he did that. Certainly nothing wrong with travelling to find a wife. My wife comes from the other side of the world. But it was strictly forbidden for the Jews at that time to marry their neighbours. And this was all about falling back into idol worship. I think there's a passage there Laura may put up in Joshua 23, which just tells a little bit, I won't bother reading it, about the Jewish law, about not marrying the neighbours. It was very uncompromising stuff in Old Testament times. God didn't want his people to be tempted to slip back further into idol worship. Very, very contemporary issue for them in their time. And actually, it's still a big issue in New Testament times. At the end of John's epistle, the first epistle, John finished it quite sort of out of sync with the rest of his passage. And then he said, "Dear children, keep yourself from idols, whatever they may be." Conversely, the Philistines, they actively encouraged their people to intermarry with the neighbours. They thought that by intermarrying, it would be an effective way of just diluting the culture and the traditions of those around them. Perhaps they could subdue these religious extremists, the Jews, if they married them and actually got them to mix, to blend in a little bit with the people that were there. It's very easy for folk just to blend in to their surroundings around them. It was a strategy, if you like. It was a strategy which had social and political advantages. Samson's parents cautioned him against the marriage. Can you just imagine some of the dinner table conversations that must have taken place then in that Jewish household? I remember reading the book Dangerous Liaison. I'll say it in English. There was a wonderful phrase in there, and it said, "In matters of love, advice is often given, but rarely accepted." Now, Samson certainly wasn't going to accept the advice of his parents or anybody else. His father, in that society, in that culture, would have had the power to veto the marriage. He could have stopped it if he'd wanted to. It would have brought shame on his family. They would have been heartbroken at his choice that their son was going to be marrying one of the Philistines who worshipped idols. But the marriage went ahead, we read. And it's kind of an example, and a wonderful example of free will in action, isn't it? Samson had made his choice. God wasn't going to interfere. He was going to actually continue down that path. He was going to take on and marry the person that he wanted to marry. God was not going to get involved here. But we do read that this was part of God's plan. The next 20 years or so of his life, I think we can condense more or less into a paragraph just for the sake of time this morning. We read that story about the lion. As Samson went down to meet his new wife in Timnah, that's where he killed the lion. Then he was taking honey out of the carcass. He touched the carcass. He shouldn't be touching a dead body. He's a Jew. He's a Nazarite. He'd already taken that vow. He was playing fast and loose with his vows even at that point. The marriage relationship itself was lacking in trust. We repeatedly read how his wife said, "Do you trust me? Do you trust me? How can you trust me if you won't tell me these secrets?" But Samson knew personal tragedy of the greatest order in his life. And throughout part of that story, some of that we didn't read, we read that his wife was actually given to somebody else, given to her best man. And then both her and her father were murdered by the Philistines. This was revenge for one of Samson's acts. He burnt the crops and he'd killed some of the Philistines. So they took revenge by murdering his wife and father-in-law. By now, Samson's own people were finding him a little bit of a liability. They hatched a plan to try and betray him. They were prepared to compromise, to sell themselves out, if you like, to their Philistine neighbours. They said to the Philistines, "We'll actually arrange for you to actually come and collect him. We'll hatch this plan." Samson held firm. I think there's a lot to commend him for. He held firm. He knew that he had a purpose in life, and this was God's purpose. There was quite a vicious cycle of bloodshed and revenge followed. And it's quite difficult for modern ears to listen to this kind of bloodshed and revenge, but hey, we see quite a lot of it, don't we? Sally mentioned some of the things that are happening on the news. Samson became public enemy number one in the eyes of his neighbours, the Philistines. And I'd just like to pause a little bit at the moment from the history and just to think a little bit about the man. Because Samson, in the midst of this chaos, and it was chaos at times, the Spirit of God was working in him in real power. And we can read, there are about four, I think, or five examples. Don't know whether I put them on that slide there. Chapter 13, 14, 15, "The Spirit of the Lord began to stir in him as a boy. The Spirit of the Lord came on him power." Again, the Spirit of the Lord came on him in power. And again, the Spirit of the Lord came on him, Samson in power. Samson was a man who was filled with the Spirit. It's quite a contradiction, isn't there, in a sense? Because although he was filled with the Spirit, at times, well, reading the story, he didn't seem to be under the control of the Spirit. If we think of that passage in Galatians about the Spirit, love, joy, peace, you know, patience, gentleness, self-control, were these attributes that we could give to Samson? No, I think Samson didn't always use his great God-given gift of strength wisely. And quite often, Jonathan was chatting here, wasn't he, about the children, about gifts. We have a responsibility to use the gifts that God's given us, a responsibility to use them wisely. At the church weekend a few months ago, remember we had that teaching about gifts, and we began to discover the gifts and abilities that we have. I still think there's some unfinished business there, because I kind of think of a church like Alma. Yes, we began to discover what we think we're good at, but what next? Really need to be thinking about how God can sort of harness all of that ability, how God can harness that potential and use it for his good. He certainly used Samson's supernatural gift of strength for his good. And again, I think Samson has other things to commend him. We read that he led his people for 20 years. And there's not an awful lot to suggest in this passage that he wasn't anything other than an effective leader. His country actually was relatively stable through that time. Yes, he had the odd skirmish with his enemies, but hey, you know, look at our own country in the past 20 years. It's hardly been a haven of peace. There's been some skirmishes along the way. No, I really don't think Samson was a one-trick pony. I think as well as his strength, he had some real leadership capabilities. And it just kind of highlights, doesn't it, that there's a real sense that we need to be praying, as we're instructed to, for all of our leaders, whether that's church leaders or leaders in government, leaders in education, leaders in business. They carry a huge weight of responsibility, and it's our responsibility too to be praying for them and all that they do for us. When he hit 40 years old, I'm looking out here, beware of the midlife crisis, anybody who's coming up around about that age, because the next big event that we read about is that Samson, he decided to visit a sex worker in Gaza. Gaza, of all places, the capital of Philistine idol worship. We don't read why he did it, but he did it. Well, let's face it, you know, I don't think he was the first leader to be caught in a sex scandal, and he certainly won't be the last. But it nearly got him killed. The Philistines ambushed him. They came around. They tried to capture him. I sometimes wonder, and after reading this passage a couple of times, maybe this was a bit of a honey trap. Maybe the Philistines recognized Samson's weakness, and they drew him in to try and capture him. I don't know. Remember, he was public enemy number one at that time. He was ambushed, and he escaped. Living by his wits, playing fast and loose with what he knew he should have been doing, he managed to slip away, dragging the city gates behind him. And the last thing, finally, that we hear is about the beautiful Delilah. And this is the bit that captures the imagination of people. I mean, Delilah, she was beautiful, depicted in that film that Jonathan put a slide up earlier on the projector. Samson was infatuated. He was captivated by her beauty, and Delilah was captivated by money and power. We read on the slide earlier of the Philistine state. It was a Pentapolis. It was a five-city state. And the five rulers of that state saw an ideal opportunity to capture their enemy here. If you can kind of think of five prime ministers or five heads of state from the EU, topical subject, approaching an ordinary person and having a conversation and offering vast sums of money, it would have been something like that. They would have come to Delilah, they would have taught her about her responsibilities to hand over this man who was a great threat to the people. But hey, not only did they do that, they offered her vast sums of wealth. 1,100 shekels of silver each if she would find out the secret of her strength. Whether we calculate that on post or pre-Brexit exchange rate terms, I'm told it was something like £60,000 or £70,000. It's an awful lot of money. Delilah would have been a very wealthy woman and independent financially for the rest of her life. She complied. We don't read why she complied, but she complied. And she did get Samson to reveal the secret of his strength. He explained how he was a Nazarite, and his strength was signified by his long hair. And I think the saddest piece of this whole story was in that latter bit that Ruth read. And it was in verse 24. Terribly sad. It said, Samson didn't know that the Lord had left him. God had been with him all of this time when he flirted with danger. But he didn't even know that the Lord had left him. Perhaps he'd become desensitized to the things that he'd been doing. But there's no question about it. Samson's world had collapsed around him now. Not only had he been captured, imprisoned, made to perform like a circus act, God had left him. The Lord had left him. The better news is that although the Lord had left him, we read that, God had not abandoned him. God was still there. God was still working in that whole difficult situation. And we read that during that time in prison, Samson, maybe he'd had time to reflect, and he decided to pray earnestly to God about this situation. Mind, even his prayer was tinged with an ulterior motive, wasn't it? He was asking if he could get revenge on his enemies because they put his eyes out. But he decided to pray to God, and that's what he did. I have friends who work in the prison service, and I knew a prison chaplain, and I remember once saying that quite often when people actually have time to reflect upon their life in prison, they're there for a long time, they do think about the deeper things, and there's actually quite a high conversion rate of people who come to faith when they are spending time in prison. Samson was at rock bottom. We prayed earnestly to God, and God did answer that prayer. And we read in that dramatic finale how his hair grew. His hair grew, his strength returned, and he managed to actually put down that temple of Dagon in Gaza. This was the very same temple where King Saul was, Saul's head was hung by the Philistines. This was a real capital of idol worship. And at the end of his life, we can just see how he killed more people. We read, oh, he killed more when he died than when he lived. This was a final act of self-sacrifice by Samson. He'd given his life to the cause. He really had. Jesus' words about greater love has no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. Well, we've got to think about it. The Jews were prepared to hand him over, weren't they, not so long ago? Yet he'd given his life for the purpose that he was set out to do. What lessons can we learn? Well, I think as Jonathan mentioned earlier, there are areas of Samson's life which clearly we wouldn't want to emulate. I think one of the less obvious things is that God may be calling us to start a job only to see others finish it. Perhaps that's true of us. Samson had fulfilled his mission. His mission was, we read it so many times, to begin the deliverance of the Philistine, of the Israelites, from the hand of the Philistines. And that's exactly what he did. He weakened those who were oppressing them. He didn't actually finish the job. It would be left to those after him who would actually do that, if we think of Samuel, David, and others later on. God sometimes calls us to start a work. Not always, but sometimes to start a work. I watched this great program a couple of years ago, and it was about Rick Stein the chef. Do you know one of these programs where they trace back your family? And much to Rick Stein's amazement, one of his ancestors had been a missionary in Canton in China in the 1880s, a Methodist missionary. And you know how they have all of the resources available. They visited the University of Hong Kong and traced back to where the graveyard was. They visited the Methodist Society, traced back some of the details. And it was a heart-wrenching tale. He and this relative and his wife and his baby had travelled to Canton. They were amongst the first to arrive in this village in the late 1800s, and they were regarded with real suspicion. They weren't treated terribly well at the beginning. The child actually died. The second child took very, very ill, and they tried to get a letter home back to the UK so that they could get passage back. Well, the letter got lost somewhere. And finally, both of the missionaries died in Canton, and Rick Stein visited their grave. It was quite an overgrown place, but it was an early missionary graveyard there. And one of the things they were saying is how they had begun to forge relationships with those around them. They'd actually just opened the pathway. People began to trust them. But you can just imagine if they could see that country 100 years later, with the many millions of Christians that now worship there. And that made it all worth it. Sometimes God chooses people to begin a work and not to finish it. I think the other thing perhaps we could learn is that we do have this responsibility to use our gifts wisely, to use them effectively. It's quite easy to be good at a few things and to let things lie a little dormant. And I think in a church like ours here, where we have many gifted and able people, it just kind of occurs to you, if everybody was maximizing their potential all at once, you know, firing on all cylinders, just what good that could do. Life isn't like that, we know. Often some people are a little bit up, some people a little down. That's how life works. But we do have a responsibility to use our gifts wisely. The other thing is, I think that God certainly can use flawed people. He uses flaws, people like Samson. Gideon had his flaws. Others of these greats had their flaws. But they still had an immense impact upon God's work. In this whole complex area of human relationships, I don't feel too qualified to comment on all of this, but I'd say perhaps it's good just to pray about such things, to seek the advice of a trusted friend. Samson wasn't terribly keen on taking advice, but it's always good in such circumstances to seek advice. And finally, I think the last thing which I think is helpful is just to remember that ultimately this tale of Samson, it's a story of redemption. Even when our world collapses, God is still there. We read, didn't we? God actually left Samson at one point, but he certainly did not abandon him. God will always be there for those who turn to him. I think in this story, the long period of time that restoration took It was signified, wasn't it, by the length of time it took for Samson's hair to grow. You think how much your hair grows in a week, you know, for his long braids to grow. How long did that take? Maybe 6 months, maybe a year. Sometimes the restoration can take time. There are consequences for actions, but God is always there to give second, first, and even third chances. He is faithful for those who turn to him earnestly. We began by talking about Muhammad Ali. Now, Muhammad Ali will undoubtedly go down in the Boxing Hall of Fame. He'll be listed as one of the greatest heavyweight title holders of all time. And we come across Samson once more later on in the New Testament. And where is that? It's in the Hebrews Hall of Faith. Samson is remembered in the Hebrews Hall of Faith alongside greats such as Abraham, Moses, Gideon, Rahab, David, and a whole list of others. This flawed man was a man of faith who was used by God. And we read in that part in Hebrews that through faith they conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised. How God can use ordinary people, whatever their strengths and weaknesses may be. And I just pray this morning that God, by his Spirit, might just help each of us to maximize our own gifts to his potential. He may use our strengths. He may be with us in our weaknesses, and that his kingdom may be furthered through all that we do. Amen.